total temperature. So going abruptly from a warm temperature to the colder water temperature is more of a shock on our system that our senses acclimate and try and auto-regulate the temperature as long as it's not too low. Then when you get out of the water, as Dick mentioned, you have evaporation. You don't have evaporation when you're inside the water because the water isn't evaporating into a gas in the middle of the ocean or wherever. So when you get out of the pool or out of the ocean, you are now have a air liquid interface that's evaporating, that's boiling off, if you will, the heat of evaporation. So that's that part. As far as packing refrigerators, I guess it has to do more with the insulation and whether or not you open or close the door too much. If you have perfect insulation and you keep the door closed, I don't think it's a problem. I think in the real case of opening and closing and suboptimal thermal insulation, the more packed it is, the more it's kind of temperature inertia holds it at that freezing point.
Let me add something to this, Roy. When I first climb into the ocean, which the water feels cold to me, I think one of the adaptations of the body is to constrict the veins at the skin level so that the rate of heat loss of body heat into the water decreases. I think that's one of the adaptations that happens, and therefore when you're in the ocean for a while, you don't feel as cold because of that adaptation. Is that possibly what's going on, Roy?
It's an adaptation to limit temperature loss, but you also have to kind of function in that you try it with your hand. You put your hand in cold water, and it feels cold. The rest of your body is not, and I don't think you're going to have that much sympathetic reaction and vasoconstriction, but your sense organs kind of get used to things to a degree. So it's a combination, like everything, it's complicated, combination of both of these things, but it certainly is a very important thermoregulatory capacity that human beings have even in regular environment. In the cold, you will have a vasoconstriction of your around your skin, and the blood flow will be located in the core where it's somewhat thermally insulated from the cold temperature.
You guys are awesome. Thank you. ACTR.
Very welcome, Kay. Dick, I think we've talked this out. If you want to talk some more, that's fine, but I don't want to take anything more away from Paul tonight.
I think it's time to flip over Paul. WSQN is going to be on Selden, therefore we're going to hear him well with today's space report, K2RW. Go right ahead, Paul.
You're right about that, Dick. I am on Selden. This is WSQN for the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet. And good topics tonight. And first thing I wanted to talk about was a rocket that was supposed to go up tonight around a little after 5 o'clock this afternoon, but it didn't go. And it was a rocket by India. It was going to go off, well, nighttime in their location. They were going to launch the Chandrayaan-2 launch spacecraft to the moon. So that's the goal. It was delayed because they came up with a problem just about 1 hour before launch with the, not with the spacecraft, but with the rocket vehicle itself. Using the large launch vehicle. They have a couple of them. They have a smaller one and a larger one. Smaller one is the polar, you know, they use for polar launches. And then they use another one called the geosynchronous satellite launch vehicle. So liquid fuel, liquid oxygen, but this is a newer version. They now have two solid boosters attached to them, one on port, one on starboard. And they used to use liquid fuel boosters. They were undersized for this type of a flight, and they got this one going after a couple of years of testing, and now that. They've come a long way with this, and they're ready to go. So my guess will probably be short they haven't rescheduled this. And it's their second shot at the moon. This one will also orbit the moon, but it does have a lander attached to the top of it. It's got these four legs, and they plan on landing near the southern end of the moon on this particular flight. And after it lands, they have a door that's going to open up, and this rover weighs around 60 pounds. It's going to come out of the lander and drive around on the moon. They'll be the fourth country to do that. We did it. Russia has done it. China and now India. So they're doing pretty good there. Unfortunately, the rocket didn't go off. I was going to watch it live. They had it on spaceflight.com, but the word came down that wasn't going to make it. It doesn't just shoot right to the moon. It does many orbits around the Earth. I think at least a half a dozen orbits, and each time when it gets to perigee, it ignites its engine and gets a little bit more push. And every time it does that, it gets further and further out, closer to the moon. Eventually, it gets caught up by the gravitational well of the moon. It's going to come around in front of it, and it's going to go into a polar, close to a polar orbit of the moon itself. And present plans, if it goes off, let's say within a day or two, is to, if this one went off, it was going to land September 6th. So they've been at this a long time. Their plans of doing this, so about 10 years ago. But they were going to do a joint joint mission with Russia. Russia was going to develop the lander, and they wound up with problems. We dropped it. They had a vehicle that was supposed to go to Phobos around Mars, and that thing it never got out of Earth orbit, so they canceled their plans with Russia, and here it is around 10 years later, and they developed their own lunar orbiter, lunar lander, and lunar rover. To do that. So, you know, I'll report on this next week if they get off the ground. It's a little bit more advanced rover than what China has. It has an X-ray spectrometer on board. China didn't have that. China had two rovers land since 2013. They had one rover land on the near side of the moon, and then this last one was on the far side of the moon. But they didn't carry a spectrometer. This thing's gonna, you know, figure out what's in the on the surface. And we'll look forward to seeing India get a launch off. NASA was involved a little bit anyway. They were going to use their deep space tracking to follow the spacecraft out. So they cancel that. Let me drop it. Virgin Galactic, now that's the company run by Richard Branson. His ultimate goal is to put six passengers on board a spacecraft called Unity. That's what he named his new spacecraft. They are, you know, they're getting close to that point where they're going to be able to put passengers on it. So far they've put a pilot, a co-pilot, and actually one passenger, somebody from that company, Virgin Galactic, and they made it to a suborbital space and came back and landed on a runway out in Mojave Desert. They're gearing up for another test flight, and most likely one or two after that, they'll probably take passengers. So he apparently needs some money to keep this going, and he's going to put himself on the stock exchange, and that should happen in a couple of months. Not that I care about the stock market, but this guy has got big plans. He thinks within a year, like probably the second quarter of, you know, the second half of 2020, he thinks he'll already have 15 commercial flights that have gone up. He's going to guess that there's going to be 66 customers, and each one paying $250,000 to go on to these suborbital flights. And he's expecting you know, real revenue coming in from this. And, you know, he's got some investors that have, you know, involved with him. Increased the amount of money, I think, $700 million recently into the company. But now going on to the stock market, that will, he hopes that will, you know, even change more and he'll have more money to work with. He still owns over 50% of the company. But, he, you know, like I said, he thinks he's going to get around at least 16 flights off next year. And beyond that, he's thinking around 250 to 300 flights, where, you know, he might have 1,500 new astronauts, you know, confirmed that within, let's say, 3 or 4 years. So, you know, he's counting on his spacecraft, Spaceship 2, they call it. And he, like I said, he named it Unity. The first one was named Enterprise, but that was the one that crashed back in 2014. Now he's rebuilt this one. He's presently building two more, and you know, they're under construction. And he's also planning on building another White Knight 2 carrier aircraft. How this Unity gets up to space, if you've listened to that, you know, I probably talked about this a million times. He's got this White Knight 2 carrier. It's got 4 jet engines on it, and it's got 2 fuselages, and in the middle he attaches the spacecraft with the half a dozen passengers and 2 crewmen, and he just drops it at 8 or 9 miles up, 45,000 feet, I think, and then it lights up this hybrid rocket and gets into, straight up until he gets to over the Kármán line, which is like 62 miles, 100 kilometers up. And then this whole contraption starts folding where the wings actually split. It's hinged, and that gives him some kind of drag, and that slows the whole thing down and eventually goes back to atmosphere. Presently, he's been testing quite a few flights in California and Mojave, and he's got plans. He's already moved a lot of stuff over to the newer facility where the customers would go and train for a day or two before getting into this Spaceship 2. And that new spaceport is called Spaceport America, and that's been built by taxpayers of New Mexico. Located in New Mexico, southern New Mexico, and it's place all built up. They've launched some rockets from there, some suborbital rockets for a couple of companies, Vector and a couple of other ones. But this is the main guy that's going to be moving to Spaceport America for now. So for a small price of $250,000, you can get a ride on into suborbital space and get your astronaut wings. I think you get up to around 3,000 miles per hour around that speed. You know, you're not going 17,500 miles. You're not going to get up to orbital speed, but you know, you still qualify. You're going to see the curvature of the Earth and get a few minutes of weightlessness before you come back down and land on a runway that's already been built in New Mexico. So let me drop it. Hopefully, if it works out, he plans on having a hypersonic jet version of this type of vehicle where you could, you know, put people on that would like to get to, let's say, Los Angeles to Tokyo, all the way around the world. And instead of doing it in, you know, 11, 12, 13 hours of commercial air traffic, you'll be able to do it in 2 hours. But don't ask me what that ticket will cost. It's like, I guess, a lot of plane flights, the way it started, you know, a lot of rich people were traveling first, and eventually, if it becomes popular enough, you'll be able to do it more often. He's got another vehicle that he's planning on building, Spaceship 3, which would be a newer version. So if all this works out, he plans on having 5 regular Unity type of vehicles flying from different locations here in the States, and he wants to build another one in Scotland, I think, and another one in Italy. So, big plans for Richard Branson with Virgin Galactic. Let me drop it for any comments or questions.
Questions?
Yeah, waiting for the tone. That sounds like K. AC2LRWS.
This is indeed K. And if you want to save time, I can look this up. But I was just wondering, you said that the Chandrayaan spacecraft would be affected by the moon's gravitational well. I'm wondering if there is any difference between the gravitational field of a body and the gravitational well, AC2LR.
Yeah, I just use that term for any body. You know, the sun's gravitational well, you try to get away from that. The Earth's gravitational well, and the moon. And, of course, we all know that moon is one-sixth what we have here. So the 60-pound lander, I think it's 50-some-odd pounds, the 60-pound, not lander, rover that's going to be riding around, will have the equivalent of riding around 10 pounds, like it'll be a 10-pound thing on the moon. So I think that's about it. There might be something of a more technical difference that I don't know. Back to you, Gary.
Okay, thank you very much. AC2LR.
Okay, very good. Thanks for your question. One thing I just want to go over is there's been a lot of news reports, not a lot, but a few news reports I've heard where they think that a lot of Apollo 11 tapes have been missing, and NASA lost this and lost that, and people are claiming to come up with newer videos and things like that. And it turns out NASA actually had an article saying that nothing was ever lost. 50 years ago, they did use certain types of recording equipment that they would erase and, you know, go over it, you know, with other stuff afterwards. But before anything was ever erased, it was always transmitted back to mission control, you know, specifically from Australia. Australia was the first receiving antenna that picked up, you know, Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. And they just wanted to let the public know that, you know, there's nothing really missing out there. They used to, you know, make video. The video that came back was usually a slow scan, and it was like, you know, every 10 seconds or so they'd have another picture, and then eventually they would put the pictures together, and it was a little jerky. I remember looking at that when it first came back, and, you know, it was essentially slow scan pictures that came back, and then they put them together, and then they transmitted it as a video, and NASA would, you know, put that on the air. So that's the story on that. So if you see stories that say that, it's, you know, somebody found tapes, it's most likely, you know, unlikely. What they did do is they found, you know, some of the recordings at different locations that happened to be better in some respects than to other pictures. So they used them. But, you know, the same 10 video frames per second that came back was just standard, you know. And I know we looked at our pictures on TV. They're like 30 frames per second. Well, this was 10 frames per second, and the resolution was different than what we see today. But of course, that all changed over time. You had your first color videos coming back from, I think, Apollo 10 started doing that. From orbit. Naturally, the pictures and film that was done directly on the moon was extremely high quality. If you see that was not transmitted. We didn't see that sitting in our living rooms. I would not have seen it. Back then we had black and white TV. There were some people that used to have color TVs in 1969, but I wasn't one of them. This WS2M. I just want to bring that up before 50th anniversary. Let's see. Let me just drop and see if anybody has any comments before I go on. This is WS2N. Okay. Israel launched they sent, let me put it this way, they sent a vehicle to the moon a few months ago, and they were on a, they were a second payload on a Falcon 9 rocket that SpaceX launched, so actually the United States launched it, put up by a private company, and it got very close to actually landing on the moon. You know, it was separated from the payload. It was an Indonesian satellite that was the main payload, but this was secondary, and it eventually it got all the way to the moon, similar to what India is doing. They'd have all these orbits and eventually get caught up into the gravity well of the moon, and then they had a live transmission of, you know, them in their control room in Israel. It was weird because they were all speaking Hebrew. I didn't expect that. You know, and they, unfortunately, they didn't have enough, they didn't have any translators, so I wasn't too sure what was going on when they were doing that. But it was pretty cool. You know, you got the feel of what they were doing. They had the animation going. In Atlanta, it was called Bereshit, and I always mispronounced that. I think I got it right now. I think Dr. Roy always tells me what it is, and I have to forget, but I believe it's Bereshit Lander, and it was coming in, and they eventually were trying to slow down. It got turned around 180 degrees when one of the rocket jets ignited. They were pulse rocket jets. They weren't variable. You know, they didn't have really good control over it. They thought they were going to come down with these pulsing actions and land on the moon, but at one point they were facing forward, and the rocket jet went on and made them actually go fast. I think they hit the moon around 500 miles per hour, and that was the end of Bereshit. Well, it turns out this one company liked their design, an American company called Firefly. And Firefly company is developing their own rocket for launch, and they think they might be able to launch probably next year. And not a very big rocket, but a good-sized rocket. They think they're going to be able to put around 2,000-plus pounds into low Earth orbit. But if it's something lighter than that, they think they could push that eventually to the moon. And their rocket is called the Alpha. They have Alpha boosters, so they're going to have one Alpha booster and then a payload on top. And then it's going to be a similar setup to what Falcon 9 does. They'll take two extra boosters, put one on the starboard, one on port, and that's what they're going to be doing in the future. So they decided to copy or mimic the Bereshit lander, and now developing their own lander, and to honor the Israel, to, you know, the company in Israel that that almost made it, they're going to name it Genesis. It turns out Genesis is the translation of Bereshit. So they're going to give them that honor. And they're building this thing, and they think that they could do this within a couple of years, yet they haven't made a launch yet. Firefly has done some suborbital tests, but they haven't gone orbital yet. We'll see. I know they have a lot of money poured into that company over the last year or two. They've apparently they got another investor or somebody involved that apparently knows what they're doing. Now they're coming along with these. A lot of these things are now being 3D printed. You know, the engines and the bodies of the rocket and everything, and they're going to set this up like a factory and mass produce these Alpha rockets made by Firefly. Okay, one other topic I was going to cover to some degree, because they were just successful, is the Hayabusa 2 mission. But I know Dr. Roy had a lot of information regarding this last week and maybe even this week. It was successful, and, you know, I just have the preliminary stuff dealing with this stuff, you know, the weight and the line, you know, how big it was and that type of thing. But, you know, he's done a couple of reports on Hayabusa 2 in the past. This is the one that's gone out to an asteroid and got involved with landing and everything, and it's not a NASA mission. This is comes out of Japan. So I don't know if Roy, do you want to pick that up, or should we let this go to, you know, for another week? You're going to need more time or something. AC2GS WS2N.
I can do it if you want to, but I don't want to take time away from you. It'll stay for next week.
No. This is good because, you know, they were successful, and you know, there might be big news next week. So if you have it handy, I would do it. It's a fascinating achievement by Japan. You know, that's one thing I like. You know, everybody talks about, well, the space program, we don't put that much money into it. Now, you know, it used to be just us and the Russians. Now China's involved, Japan, and then, you know, Israel, private companies. You know, there's a lot of money going into space exploration and development. Over to you, Roy, if you want to do it. If not, we'll let it ride.
Yeah, cool. It's fine. Earlier this past week, Japan's Hayabusa 2 may have become the first probe in history to collect material from beneath the surface of an asteroid, a mission that could yield important new insights about the early stages of our solar system. The attempt alone is an exciting achievement, but we won't know for sure whether the probe successfully gathered samples until it returns to Earth later next year. From the data sent from Hayabusa 2, it has been confirmed that the touchdown sequence, including the discharge of a projectile for sampling, was completely successful. The Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency announced in a press release issued just this past week. The probe performed its brief touchdown at 10:06 a.m. Japanese time and is functioning normally, according to JAXA. This is now the second time Hayabusa 2 has visited the surface of Ryugu, a 2,854-foot-wide asteroid located 186 million miles from Earth. The first touchdown happened this past February, during which time the probe fired a projectile into Ryugu's surface, kicking up surface material, which it then collected. The second visit is notable in that Hayabusa 2 attempted to collect subsurface material, which had never been done before. Back in April, the probe fired an impactor, a tantalum bullet, into Ryugu's surface, which produced an artificial crater surrounded by underground material. This stuff is precious to scientists as it's shielded from the effects of space weathering, including the effects of cosmic rays and charged particles pouring off the sun. These samples will shed new light on the origin of the solar system and what it was like billions of years ago. Let me drop for a second. This second operation to visit the asteroid surface began on July 9th with Hayabusa 2's slow journey to the surface starting on July 10th. When it reached a distance of 30 meters, that's 98 feet for us, the probe located a marker it had deposited earlier and adjusted its trajectory accordingly. The probe made a brief landing at a site designated CO1CB region, which is around 20 meters from the artificial crater. The touchdown itself lasted just a few seconds, during which time the probe fired a small projectile onto the surface. This produced a field of floating debris that fell into its collection tube, or so we hope. Hayabusa 2 then rose back up to a safe distance where it will continue to monitor the asteroid and the sampling site. This mission was potentially risky as Hayabusa 2 already attempted to gather surface samples. The failure there could have disabled the spacecraft, preventing it from delivering its valuable cargo back to Earth. Thankfully, that doesn't appear to be the case, with mission controllers calling this past week's landing perfect. It was a success, a big success, said Hayabusa 2's team member Takahashi Kubota at a press conference held just this last week, as reported by New Scientist. Quote, we achieved success in all our scheduled procedures, end quote. Interestingly enough, the AFP news agency reports the sample canister will be deposited into Earth's atmosphere for reentry, but the probe itself will remain in space. According to JAXA, it is contemplating an extended mission in which Hayabusa 2 could be dispatched to visit yet another asteroid. That's it for now. This is AC2 GS.
Very, very good, Roy. And they're probably very happy about that. There was a Hayabusa 1 years ago and didn't come back and they got something back, but not that much. It was a different asteroid. So, but you know, this one sounds very successful. They really got their act together. I think when they leave, they're going to leave a couple more cameras or something on a asteroid. I think they're going to leave. So that's quite an accomplishment. The Tantalum thing that, I think you said Tantalum, is that the same thing as what they would use for a capacity, do you think? Or why do they use that material instead of like iron, you know? Big piece of steel. Back to you, Ryan.
Yeah, Tantalum is the same material made out of capacitors. Very efficient and long-lived and can be small. I assume it has something to do with reactivity and density. And, you know, space agencies can afford to buy expensive materials for their mission.
Very good. Yeah, very good. And you said an extended mission. See, I guess it could. It's got these ion engines. There's four ion engines like any other rocket. You know, just to get off the Earth, you need chemical rockets, you know, powerful stuff. Once you're out there, you could use these ion engines, which turn on, and they could stay on for years without a problem. And there's four on board. One is actually a backup. They don't even use it, so they'll use their... I don't know if they ever run three at the same time, but maybe they do. I don't know. Nevertheless, they have ion engines with the xenon gas. So I guess maybe they're going to go off to another asteroid. Is that what you're thinking?
Appears to be the idea that the beauty of the space missions to asteroids, since the gravitational attraction is so minimal, basically if you walk too fast on the surface, you'll end up leaving the asteroid. So it doesn't really require a lot of propellant to put it someplace else, and there might be other asteroids that the Japanese are eyeing. I don't think they have any more probes available to drop down into it, so it'll probably just be snapping pictures and sending signals back. But that's one of the things they're going to be discussing for a while, whether to take Hayabusa 2 to yet another asteroid to figure out what's going on with it.
Yeah. Even just pictures to get something like that, you know, would cost, just for another flight, these things all cost a couple of $100 million just to launch from Earth. And this thing is going, just, you know, leave the ion engines on a little longer and they're going to get free pictures from somewhere else. Okay, very good. Thanks for that, Roy. Just want to comment on a rocket failure that just happened last week. European Space Agency launches basically three different types of rockets. You know, they have a small, medium, and large. You know, they have smaller payloads, medium payloads, and the heavy-duty payloads. The heavy-duty ones are launched by the Ariane 5 rocket. You know, if you're going to launch something big, sometimes two heavy satellites, you know, they might be collectively 20 or 30,000 pounds. You use the Ariane 5 rocket, and soon to be followed by the Ariane 6 next year. I think that's going to come online. Been developing that for the last, 10 years almost. And then they have a medium weight rocket, which is the Soyuz 2B rocket. They buy these things from Russia and get it to French Guiana. These are all launched from South America, by the way, from French Guiana, Kourou. French Guiana have their launch complex set up there, and they could launch geosynchronous, they could launch polar. The European Space Agency has the Soyuz vehicle, and they retrofit it to their own purposes, and they make some changes, and that's how they get their medium-weight satellites into space. And then there's their light version made over in Italy. It's called the Vega rocket, and they've launched a half a dozen times, I think six or seven times, over the last few years. It's been very successful. It's a solid booster rocket. only stands, I think, 130 feet high or something. It's designed by a European Space Agency, put together by Italy. They floated over to French Guiana, and they, you know, every one so far has been successful. And they were going, like, they were launching a, they call it the Falcon Eye 1 satellite for United Arab Emirates. They needed a spy satellite up there. But it launched successfully. You can watch these things live. Again, if you go to spaceflight.com, they'll tell you the next flight sometimes. You click on it, you know, 10, 15 minutes, sometimes a half hour before, and they'll give you all the information about the rocket and the payload, whatever it might be. So that's always pretty good to watch. And in this case, it got off the off ground fine. You know, the first stage went okay, and then it's a multi-stage solid booster rocket. And when it got to the last, it apparently had a problem. Rocket, you know, ignited, but it was facing the wrong way, and it just re-entered the atmosphere. And that was the end of their rocket. So it's a 100-foot tall rocket that failed. Which has been pretty successful. So now they're going to look into that, and that's going to slow things down for European Space Agency for the small payload launches. But that could help companies like SpaceX or even this other one I was talking about, Firefly, or even another American company, even though they're not launching out of America yet, they're launching out of New Zealand called Rocket Lab. They're launching the Electron rocket successfully. I think they've done around 7 or 8 flights now. And they, in fact, I said they don't launch out of the United States. This guy, Peter Beck, who runs Rocket Lab, will be doing that probably the end of this year. Right now, he's got a crew, big crew, building his launch facility in Wallops Island, Virginia. Not too far from where the Antares rocket takes off. Antares is the one that has the Cygnus spacecraft. It's a cargo vehicle that goes up to the National Space Station to resupply them. Well, they made available a launch pad for Rocket Lab. So they'll be launching there soon. So, because they had a failure with their small launch vehicle, at the European Space Agency, who knows, that might actually help for a while companies like Firefly or even, you know, SpaceX, you know. But might have a couple of other companies like Vector involved. They plan on launching within a year or so as well. These are all companies that have orbital rockets in mind. Let me drop it. Okay, another company with that will be launching smaller rockets is, I mentioned Virgin Galactic before. Well, they also have a company called Virgin Orbital, which is a spinoff. It's really the same company owned by Richard Branson. You know, they spin off companies. This is the one with the launcher. They call it that's actually the name of the rocket. The launcher is going to be. Launcher 1, it's officially called, is going to be attached to a 747. I named this 747 Cosmic Girl. And they've run some tests over the last couple of years to see if this thing would be okay to just drop from a 747 without, affecting the airplane. And, when you drop a heavy weight like that, sometimes bad things might happen. Well, just last week they did successfully do that. They launched, they dropped this rocket called Launcher 1 without any fuel in it. They loaded up with water, so just to duplicate the weight, and then the Launcher 1 came down and crashed into the Mojave Desert. But they just wanted to see if it was going to be successful, and they think maybe in the next couple of months they might be able to have their first launch with that vehicle. Another test coming up Tuesday. Nothing to do with that. Has to do with SpaceX down in Texas. Goal is to go to Mars. Well, he's got this vehicle called the Starship he's building. and that's his goal, is to eventually use this thing to go to Mars or even the moon. What he's developing now is it's like a Falcon 9 on steroids. It doesn't use the same fuel. It's not using kerosene. It's using a liquid methane and a liquid oxygen. And he's building the test vehicle right now. It's called the Starhopper. Its goal is to like fly this eventually up to, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 miles high and come back and land in the same place it took off. It hasn't gone anywhere right now. It looks like a gigantic fuel tank with wings on it, and you know, probably about 100 feet high. And he put one Raptor engine. A Raptor engine is the new liquid methane, liquid oxygen engine that's much more powerful than the old Merlin engines that he used in the foot of Falcon 9. And he put one of these engines in a couple of, he had it tethered to the ground where it wouldn't go anywhere. But this time he's not going to tether it, but he's going to try to get it up, they said, at 20 meters. So we're looking at 60, 70 feet off the ground. And he wants to see if that works. And ultimately, he plans on, as the months, maybe years go by, he plans on eventually having the Starhopper test vehicle. Which is a big thing. It's wide. It's as wide as what the Starliner will look. The Starship will look like, around 30 feet in diameter. So, but when completed, he's going to have a booster behind that called the Starship Heavy, and that's going to have the same Raptor engines, but it's going to have 31 of them. And that will eventually propel the Starship to orbit and eventually onto the Moon and Mars. And it would also be able to re-enter the atmosphere as well. So that's the story on that. Any comments or questions? This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet as I run out of time.
AC2LR with a quick comment.
Go ahead, Kay. Usually we got 1 or 2 minutes after the witching hour. Back to you, Kay.
I've been trying to observe the moon, observe 100 objects on the moon, and then as a reward. But I found this book called The Moon Observer's Guide, Second Edition, by Peter Grego, G-R-E-G-O. It's so amazing. It has so many detailed photographs of different parts of the moon, and a whole segment on the different space missions and pictures that were taken during the space missions, like, you know, angles of the back of the moon, the other side of the moon where we can't see from Earth, and I just thought you might be interested in that book. It's called The Moon Observer's Guide, Second Edition, by Peter Grego, G-R-E-G-O.
Okay, now I wrote it down. Very good. Moon Observing Guide, Peter Grego, and I look forward to it. Over Barnes & Noble. Thanks for that. Second edition. So thanks for that, Kay. Any other... we don't have time. Let me turn it over to Dick. K2RIWWS2N.
Hi, thank you, Paul. Good stuff. We're going to turn it back to Roy in case he wants to reissue his addresses for mailbag and whatever. AC2, GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, thank you very much, Dick. As always, if you have any topics you would like me to cover, if you have any questions you'd like me to try to answer, if you don't agree with what I say and you want to give me your opinion about something, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@, and my call sign is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. And the article on Hayabusa 2 will be available with a link on roy.ac2guest.com. You just have to go there, click on the link, and you can read and look at pictures. So I once again thank everyone who participated tonight, and thank Dick and Paul for giving me the opportunity to do that. So this is Alpha Charlie 2 Gulf Sierra, and I will be clear, and I will think up some new stuff for next week.
Yeah, your puzzle was a good one tonight. You got a lot of participation there, Roy. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. See you guys next week. K2LRW clear. And by the way, Roy, when you get a chance, I sent you and Paul a example of an email we received recently where we're very appreciated.
You send that to Dick, because I haven't gotten it yet. You might have sent it to a different address.
I sent it 5 minutes before the TechNet began, so you probably haven't seen it yet.
No, I'm staring at stuff. I got email from 10:29 p.m., so I guess I'll look in the spam folder. I don't think it should go there, but I'll look. If you have nothing better to do, just double-check that email address, because sometimes people type in the wrong thing.
Okay, I'll double-check.
Yeah, it came to me right before the net, so try that time frame. WHRY, are you aware of the new specials coming on this week at 10 o'clock on Channel 2 about Apollo 11?
Yes, I am, Joe. And this is the week of 50 years ago, Apollo 11 landing. And boy, PBS, CBS, ABC, they're all issuing special reports about it.
Yeah, I watched the program they had on this morning for a half hour. It was pretty interesting. And I did actually learn something by watching the program. I actually learned who made the spacesuits. Do you know who made the spacesuits for them?
The company that makes brassieres. I can't think of the name of the company right now.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. Good morning, the time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2L repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater.